You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. Have you ever heard of industrial musicals? I had not until I saw the film Bathtubs Over Broadway, which we're going to be talking about on today's program. We'll be hearing from Steve Young, who has brought this whole kind of secret world of industrial musicals to today's audiences. But first, I want to give you a taste of what these American corporate musicals sound like.
The dishwasher and the disposal, they're on the move.
Oh, trucks are more than power and weight or the size of the differential. There's the big reward of the profit stored in the extra sales potential.
I'm a tractor driving man. If I'm bragging, don't mind me. When you're looking for me, in that tall seat you'll find me. Plowing a field with a sunset behind me. Driving, driving, driving.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Steve Young. He's a comedy writer who worked for 25 years on The David Letterman Show. He's co-author of the book Everything's Coming Up Profits, The Golden Age of Industrial Musicals, and he's subject of the documentary Bathtubs Over Broadway. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey, thank you, Mary Charlotte. My pleasure.
So you were here in Santa Fe earlier this year for the screening of Bathtubs Over Broadway at the Santa Fe Film Festival with filmmaker Deva Wisenant, and I fell in love with this film. It's about a genre of American musical that most of our listeners probably aren't aware of called industrial musicals. Tell us what this genre is and how you chanced across this whole world and subculture.
Yes, it really is a vast hidden part of American show business history and cultural history of the 20th century. So everyone knows what a Broadway musical is, but imagine a Broadway musical that is all about the triumphs and tragedies of selling B.F. Goodrich tires. And everyone in the audience is a B.F. Goodrich tire dealer. These were musicals commissioned by these corporations to be performed at their annual sales conventions and sales meetings. The public could not attend them. The public was unaware that they existed. I discovered them accidentally while working for The Letterman Show. I had to gather strange record albums for a bit called Dave's Record Collection. And in the course of doing that, I began finding these mysterious souvenir albums from company events. And I thought, well, I guess it would be speeches. But no, oh my God, there were musicals with titles like Diesel Dazzle, and it was all about selling and servicing diesel engines. And I thought, well, this is insane. We can make some comedy out of this. But then the next level for me was, this is really good. There was obviously a huge amount of money poured into something like this. Everything sounded fantastic. The songs were catchy and beautiful, and the performers were all top-notch. I just thought, what is going on here? I have fallen down the rabbit hole into some alternate universe where show business is about selling appliances and dealing with the problems of being a Coca-Cola bottler. And I thought, I've got to get all of this I can. And I began not only collecting as many of the records as I could find, which is a very slow process, but then it branched out into tracking down and interviewing the people who wrote these shows and performed in them. And that is kind of the heart of Bathtubs Over Broadway. At first, it's about what is this genre and how could it possibly be so large and amazing and we didn't know about it. But then it's all about the connections that I made along the way and people I met and learning about their lives and their work. And it becomes very heartfelt and asks some profound questions.
Yeah, very much so. And I want to get to some of those profound questions because it's such a snapshot of America. But I want to make sure that people understand how big this was. I mean, there was so much money spent on these industrial musicals to the point where it exceeded the budgets of many Broadway productions. And the people who performed in these musicals were often famous people and who wrote them. They were writing shows like Fiddler on the Roof and Cabaret in Chicago. And then a lot of famous performers, like, and some of them were in the movie, Florence Henderson, Martin Short, Valerie Harper, Loretta Swit, Bob Newhart. What was it like for them working on productions that were about selling mouthwash or plastic wrap or, you know, surgical equipment?
I don't think many of these writers and performers went into that line of work thinking that's what they would do. But in many cases, a young hopeful gets off the bus in New York City and starts auditioning for legitimate shows and hoping for Broadway. But until that day comes, you got to pay the rent. And it became well known in these circles that, well, here's what you need to do. You got to start auditioning for industrials because, oh my God, they will pay you better than you've ever been paid in your life, as Martin Short says in the movie. And you're going to work with A-list people, people who are between Broadway gigs, people who are on their way up, people who are absolutely legitimate, in many cases, future stars. And yes, you're going to be singing about fluorescent light bulbs or the marketing plans for sunscreen or something. So it's not quite what you thought, but yes, it was great money. And everybody told me again and again, what a fantastic training ground. You learned your craft, you improved your chops, you learned the ropes, much more so than if you were driving a cab or being a waitress or a waiter, which is how many actors traditionally made ends meet. But boy, industrials could go for decades. So I know people who wrote stuff like this for decades and performed in it for decades, sometimes graduating out to stardom, sometimes not.
And the people who did that for decades, I mean, tell us more about how they felt. There was some pride. I mean, this was not only the golden age of industrial musicals, this was the golden age of American industry.
Yeah, there was a few really nice decades where everything was kind of working on the sort of macro level in the economy and all that. I think practitioners of this stuff who spent a long time in it felt ambivalent. They knew that they were doing very good work oftentimes and being well compensated for it and raising families and living a good life. But it was so hard to explain to anyone what they were doing. And even if you could sit someone down and explain, imagine a Broadway musical, but it's all about selling tractors. People's eyes would sort of glaze over, but then they would also maybe look at you pityingly, like, oh, too bad you never really made it.
Right.
So there was this whiff of maybe not full legitimacy. And of course, this was decades before people like me came along to ask real questions about what if this is actually really good and deserves respect. So it could be tough. You made sort of a bargain that I'm going to do well. I'm going to get to do what I want to do and make some good money. But really, no one outside this conference hall is ever going to hear this musical about lawnmowers. And that's too bad because it really is startlingly good oftentimes. So it's kind of a deal with the devil you made.
In the 1950s, a lot of the musicals were commissioned by car companies, oil companies, appliance companies, Westinghouse, Ford, so on. Then in the 1960s, everyone seemed to get in on the act. What are some of the more weird or surprising products about which they made musicals?
Yeah, by the 60s, it just seemed to be the thing to do. It was kind of like an arms race. You had to prove that you were a major player in your industry, even if you were selling car key blanks. That's one that I found. Aluminum, brightly colored car key blanks from 1965. Okay, I guess we got to prove that we're we're legitimate. Let's get together some people and do a musical. Or I think you mentioned the plastic wrap for right. Butchers. That was also the mid-60s. Roller bearings, fluorescent light tubes, mouthwash. You can almost see that it's kind of legitimate for, like, Cadillac. Okay, the new Cadillac comes out in a sort of exciting reveal with dry ice and flashing lights, and that's exciting and glamorous. Everyone wants a Cadillac. Whose heart really beats faster at the thought of, the new plastic wrap for Butchers? Yeah, maybe with a few really good songs and fun and drama and a few laughs, people kind of get psyched up for it. But it is so improbable. That's what I loved about it at some level also. Just how can this possibly be real? How can people have sincerely and legitimately put all their talents to work to write a musical about dog food or something?
Right, right. As you said, these musicals, the entire audience, and there's some pictures in your book of these audiences, and they are short-haired white guys in suits, basically. They were, you know, district managers, salespeople, executives. Did you ever come across any of the audience members, like a Ford tractor salesman or one of these people who actually saw the shows and maybe was inspired by them?
Only a little bit. When Deva was working on the documentary, we tried to track down people who'd been at the shows with limited success. We talked to one elderly Ford dealer who did have some fond memories of being at some of the Ford dealer shows, but there was no revelatory moment in what he said. So unfortunately, that psychological terrain is somewhat we don't have as much primary source material as you might want. Although I do know, talking to some of the composers who back in the day would be attending these shows and sort of watching from the wings or off to the side, they told me that if these shows were done right and conceived correctly and written beautifully with the right, really powerful, talented actors and singers, you would see up in the audience these sort of hard-bitten, cynical salesmen and dealers with tears streaming down their faces. And it just sounds crazy, but if you have these people come in and sit down in the theater and the lights go down and there's a show, a really powerful, convincing show about the work you do and the world that you know better than anyone, and yes, you're going to do well because we have got great new products and blah, 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 but often the underlying message of these shows was the work that you do really matters. It's not only benefiting you and your family, but you're making human life better by selling a tractor that people are going to use to grow food and grow textile fibers. And just you're advancing the cause of civilization by being part of this system. It could really, really get down to the base level of human motivation.
Well, that's such an interesting question. Like, did these musicals, do we have any way of knowing whether they really helped sales, whether they really inspired people to do better at their work?
I've only heard largely anecdotal things. Like one of the composers I talked to in the movie says, well, they kept inviting you back the next year. It must have worked. But I've heard other people sort of say, oh, yeah, we kind of heard that the same store sales at the McDonald's would take a bump upwards in the months after one of the conventions because people would be kind of fired up to rededicate themselves. It's very hard for me to think that that could all be sorted out cleanly because who knows what other factors were going on. But like I said, for a while, I think it really was a prestige thing. And if Chevy's doing a big show, then Plymouth's got to do a show at least as good. And then Ford's going to want to top it the next year. And everybody's got to prove that, well, we must be the dominant company in this sector because, look, we've always got the biggest show.
How did the music and libretto writers communicate with the companies? I mean, do we know what those conversations are like? Like a manager or vice president said to them, you know, okay, here's what we want to communicate with you about dog food.
Yeah, none of this really is in the book or in the movie. There's just so much that I've heard and talking to these people over the years. But yes, there would be an intake meeting where your creative, the songwriter or songwriters would come to Detroit or whatever, and there would be a long session in which, well, you know, the new cars are going to, we're going to have a high output new engine. We're going to want to emphasize that. And also the 200 series is now going to have a station wagon. So that's going to have to be mentioned, and just reams of information. And some of it, you're just going to have to think, I don't know how that's going to go in a song, but boy, they're paying us, so we're going to do it. I mean, the Silicones number that's in the movie, which is an album, but also a film, miraculously. Hank Beebe, my dear 92-year-old friend, told me, General Electric Silicones, the company told us that, well, there's about 180 uses for these products, and we want every single one of them to be fit in the show somewhere. So just, oh my God, if you can do that, though, if you can accomplish that with panache and actually pull it off, well, nothing is ever going to intimidate you again in terms of a creative assignment.
Silicones are just a must. They're also used on the lunar dust when man walked on the moon, picking up stones. The soles of his boots were made of silicones. As a construction ceiling, it's really worth noting. For industrial roofs, it's weatherproof coating. It works on the tops of the big sports domes, for sealing and for caulking in motorhomes.
Insulates the transformer on your TV set. Makes custom ski boots the best you can get. It's the coating on your waistband to make your waistband hold.
But there were other kinds of tensions. Like Hank Beebe told me that he and his late partner Bill would go to some meeting with the VPs or whatever, and you get a range of people who are, they don't care about this, or they care a little too much about this show, and somebody's always going to say, you know what would be hilarious if we have that, and just like somebody's got a god-awful idea, and they're paying your bills, and so you got to figure out how to diplomatically go, oh yeah, wow, that's interesting, you know. And then you pivot to, you know what else could be really good? You try to steer them. But Bill Heyer was a hothead. And Hank told me that he would have to actually kind of put his hand on Bill to keep him from leaping across the table and strangling executives who had horrible, horrible ideas. And sometimes everything would be figured out and you'd demo the songs for them. I have a few instances of just like piano and vocal demos by composers who would have to ship a sample off to Detroit to get the executives to sign off on the songs after all this, because they are the final arbiter of what is acceptable for these shows. And so, okay, finally back and forth, you got it all figured out. And sometimes the day of the show, performers would be standing backstage and the music would be about to start, and some VP would come up to an actor and say, we just changed the specifications on the convertible. Can you say that it's got the 348 cubic inch engine, and also that the trim level has been upgraded? Can you fit that in the song? Okay, thanks. Have fun. And they'd like run off and you go, you're on in 30 seconds. And so what the hell do I do? So boy, and performers and writers really put to the test to navigate this stuff. And it really was a special bond among the people who did this stuff, and the war stories and the ridiculous disasters and crises like that, that really could not have existed in any other kind of show business. It's a lot of fun to hear about.
Part of the beauty of this story that we see in the documentary is that this whole process of learning about these musicals was transformational for you. You suffered from an occupational hazard that in the film you call comedy damage. Tell us what comedy damage is and sort of what happened when you discovered these musicals.
I talk about comedy damage as what happened to me as a professional comedy writer after a while of too much exposure to comedy, writing it, rewriting it, thinking it, watching it, analyzing it, after a while, your receptors kind of get worn down. It's hard to be surprised by jokes after a while because you run a million schematic diagrams in your head and you just kind of go, well, that works. Okay, that's acceptable. Oh, that's smart. That's clever. And the cliche is comedy writers telling each other jokes and they all nod gravely and say, that's funny.
Right.
That's very funny. And no one's laughing. So that was kind of a price to pay for getting into the field that I aspired to. And after a while, it's just, I cannot be as entertained as civilians by mainstream comedy anymore. The kicks just keep getting harder to find. What do I do? And that's why this industrial musical stuff thrilled me so much. It seemed like this seems like it can't be real. Like comedy writers must have made this up. It's so improbable and outlandish and ornately weird, but it is real and it is better than anything I could imagine because it is real and so well done at its top level. I just thought this is a kind of comedy that broke through to a new level for me. And it will always be hilarious to me that there exist musicals about disposable paper hospital gowns or Colgate household products or whatever. It is not ever going to be anything not funny. But then all these other layers grew onto it. I was an English major. I'm a comedy writer. Now I'm suddenly getting a secret education in American history and business culture and marketing and the psychology of motivating groups and your employees, and how do you grapple with the notion that the best work you've ever done in your career might have been heard once by 300 people and then not even recorded or saved in any way. Just so many other levels open up. So it's comedy and it's way beyond comedy.
Were you able to laugh again? I mean, did you start laughing?
Oh, I laugh constantly. I do retain a very healthy ability to laugh in the moment when people say funny, spontaneous things or strange surprises happen. It's really more the realm of here is something that has been carefully, professionally written, produced, directed, edited, presented. I see the pipeline too well and intrinsically feel too much about the decisions and choices that went into it. The stuff that's really just off the cuff by smart, funny people and just surprising and absurd and surreal, that still makes me laugh. Like, I do laugh in the movie.
Yeah.
One of my actor friends, a conversation about, you must have just been delivering material that you didn't even understand. And he said, yeah, like, maybe no sense of what you're talking about, but you have to go out and talk about it. And he said, I gave a long speech at a John Deere show about liquid manure. And I just burst out laughing. It's just, all right, just the context of having this conversation with this man and this detail coming up, just that's still pretty funny.
There was no crossover between these musicals and the commercials for the same company's products. Why not? You would think that there could be, because there were such incredibly clever lyrics and catchy tunes.
Many of the writers and performers may have also done commercials, but you're right that there was very, very rarely any way for this material to escape its bubble of privacy. Like, there's one instance I know of a song from one of the Oldsmobile dealer shows that Florence Henderson was in that was adapted for a live television commercial in the late 50s, and you see a glimpse of that in the film. That is very much the exception. Hank Beebe told me at one point he and his late partner Bill had written a Dodge show, and it had some wonderful catchy songs in it. And the Dodge executive said, boy, we love this show. We love these songs. We want to take one of these. We want to make our favorite song a part of our big new ad campaign on television, radio, whatever. And of course, this would be great for Hank and Bill. They would get, I think, a new revenue stream out of that. But when the regular advertising agency that worked with Dodge heard about this, they said, oh, no, you don't. You try that, and we are going to sever our relationship with you. The stuff that those people do, that can get nowhere near our business, or we will walk. So that people are very, very territorial about this stuff.
That's so interesting. And another piece of it, you start the film by saying something like, we were never supposed to know about this. And that's sort of a theme throughout the film. Like, nobody was really ever supposed to know about these musicals. Were they, like, actively top secret, or more like there would be no reason for outsiders to know?
It was a combination. Sometimes these shows did have sensitive information in them about the new specifications of the exciting new typewriter or whatever, but really, that stuff would have a limited shelf life of confidentiality. I think there was just a sense that who would possibly ever want to listen to this again after the convention is over? Okay, yes, once in a while we'll press up a souvenir record and we'll tell people, we hope you enjoy these memories of the Goodyear convention. Listen to this record at home with your family. Relive the fun and all the exciting motivational messages. But really, it was seen as something for a very specific place and time, and who would care, really, down the road? And that's even the composers, when I would find them, they would be amazed that I had bothered to pick up the JCPenney anniversary musical or whatever. And how did you find that? You shouldn't know about that. Mm-hmm. That's crazy that you're talking to me about this. They just couldn't believe it. And the other level was that none of them really knew the scope of this genre because there was no professional association. Hank Beebe, one of the towering titans in this field, when I told him I was working on a book with my friend Sport Murphy, he said, I honestly can't see why that would be a useful thing to do. He had no idea how many other people there were like him over the decades in different cities. And when the book came out, he said, oh my God, I had no idea there was so much. And then I said, well, now we're doing a documentary. And he said, now you've really gone crazy. And then the documentary came out and he said, well, I guess I'm going to stop questioning what you're up to, because boy, you and Deva and the whole team, you really pulled off something extraordinary there.
Well, I mean, one of the things that's so interesting about that, to like what you were just saying, was, you know, we think of the 50s and 60s as a time where everybody watched the same TV shows and saw the same movies and read the same magazines and stuff. And now we're living in this time of absolutely niche journalism and, you know, niche art and because of the internet and everything. And here are these musicals that are super niche, like written for a specific group of people, like, you know, Power Distribution and the JCPenney Man. Those are songs that could barely be understood by anybody who wasn't in a really tiny demographic.
There are still details and inside jokes in some of these things, which I don't understand even to this day. So I kind of love that elusive quality of them. There was something in me early on that said, I know I am not the intended audience for this. Yeah. And that makes me all the more anxious to pull back the curtain on this, because I know it's expected that I won't care. And I'm gonna find out, can I decide for myself whether I care or not?
The whole question of what these musicals say about the United States is really profound. And in the film, you say something like, each new musical you found was like a piece of a jigsaw puzzle, but you're still not sure what the big picture was. And I'm thinking about this whole golden age of industrialism. Do you feel like you're seeing more of that picture?
It's a complex picture. Not surprisingly, I don't want to over-romanticize parts of the world of industry and business and all this. These companies, at their better impulses, yes, they were genuinely concerned about their employees and their staffers and their sales force. And the expectation was that these people are going to be with us for the long haul. We're a family. We're going to take care of them. They're going to take care of us. We're all going to win together. I do believe that there was a real version of that. But of course, always is what's the bottom line? yes, we want to get people excited so they'll go out and sell more mouthwash because we need to make money and we need this enterprise to succeed. What I think changed, well, of course, a lot of things changed. I hesitate to try to oversimplify anything, but I heard from various people who were in this world that starting in the 70s, you had consultants coming in and they were saying anything that doesn't absolutely, directly, tangibly add to the bottom line is expendable. We don't care if people like working here. We don't care if they're happy or excited. If they don't like it, they can leave and they'll be replaced. I have also heard that some people said in the old days, companies had the following masters or concerns to attend to: their own profits, their customers, their workers, shareholders, yes. But by the 70s into the 80s, shareholder value and return had moved way up to the front of the line. Everything else was distant, second, third, fourth. And that meant that caring about these personal relationships was less of a concern.
And that's when the whole genre began to more or less disappear.
Again, complicated. I always say that by the 80s, young people entering the world of sales did not maybe care so much about musical theater and Broadway, maybe as their parents had. Everybody in the 50s had My Fair Lady and the South Pacific soundtrack. By the 80s, people had grown up on Led Zeppelin and the Beatles, and you get industrial shows that are trying to chase that. 79 Fever, the world's first disco sales meeting, things like that. And the economy was changing, and some of these shows were very expensive to do. After a few decades, people said, maybe we don't need to always do this anymore. We've been doing this for a while. What else can we do? New things came in. You can do a lot with video screens, pre-recorded music. You can hire Tony Bennett to come sing for 20 minutes at your show. Not special material, nothing about being a Pepsi bottler. Just have them do 10 hits and everyone's happy and you didn't have to reinvent the wheel. So there were a lot of factors that caused the demise of this world. I've also heard from people that the tax laws changed and it was less easy to write off these extravagances as a legitimate business expense. So it definitely, by the end of the 80s, had gone way, way down, never really came back in the next business cycle. By the 90s, you did still have some car companies and pharmaceutical companies, and the occasional other company would do one. As you see in the movie, we even did find some pretty powerful examples from the 21st century. There are still a few companies that see the value in doing this.
Let's talk about a few of these musicals that are now classics within this subculture.
Yeah.
One of them is called The Bathrooms Are Coming from 1969, commissioned by the American Standard Company. Tell us about this musical.
Well, this is the great unavoidable pillar, along with a few other shows that you just have to contend with if you're going to look at this stuff. Even before I was collecting this stuff, by the early to mid-90s, cassette tapes of this show were circulating in certain underground circles of weird music aficionados. Just, oh my God, it's a whole musical about bathroom fixtures. Apparently it's real. And listen to this thing. It's crazy how elaborate it is. So I hooked onto this independently through my work on the Letterman show, but pretty soon I heard about that show. And I eventually acquired my own copy of the album, which, as I point out in the movie, not only stunningly, weirdly catchy songs, beautifully produced and sung and engineered and all that, really quite a remarkable recording. But the album cover is loaded with information about who the cast members are and what their credits are and what American Standard's reasoning behind putting the show together was. They wanted to really jumpstart a new decade of excitement about modern bathrooms. And they had a whole multi-pronged approach, including this show and the souvenir album. But the front of the album, the front cover, had all these scenes from the show. And you were looking at these images and you just thought, what was going on there? What's going on with this hillbilly and this caveman and this woman in this shiny silver costume? I guess she's the Greek goddess mentioned on the back, but what were they doing? What were they doing? And I figured, well, that's as far as we'll ever get. But as things played out miraculously, and I won't give too much away about the events that you see in the movie, I eventually found out much more about who these people were and what happened in the show, thanks to the surprise discovery of a 16 millimeter film. And that's about all I'll say about that. But and I also finally got to meet the composer who wrote these songs. That had been someone I'd looked for years. So all these people became, to my surprise now, good friends. And I know their families, and I know what's going on with their lives. And they have been so amazed and gratified by the attention 50 years later that this strange project has generated. It reverberates down all these decades of their lives. And here we are in 2019, and people are excited to hear about, oh, Pat and Sandy from the bathrooms are coming. Oh, yes, the ladies who sing the motion-activated faucet song. Oh, my God, they're here. So it's just insane, giddy fun.
I'm just going to play a little bit of this song, My Bathroom, because you just have to hear it to believe it.
My bathroom, my bathroom is a private kind of place, very special kind of place, the only place where I can stay, making faces at my face. My bathroom, my bathroom is my very special room, where I primp and fuss and groom, where I can get away from all and really feel in bloom. I'm free.
Interesting in this particular musical, but this applies to a number of them. They kind of use the cultural realities of the time. Like one, the first song on the Bathrooms Are Coming is called, you know, it's revolution, bathroom revolution. And, you know, the Bathrooms Are Coming is presumably a reference to the Beatles album, The Beatles Are Coming. And yet it's all like in service of profit and sales, not any of the actual, you know, cultural movements that were going on at that time. And in the book, you use this term pseudo-feminism. And I was wondering if you could, like, talk about that.
Yeah, Bathrooms Are Coming is a wonderful artifact that kind of places you in the world of 1969 with these cross currents of there are turbulent changes going on in society with women's rights and protest movements, but also, all right, the post-war economy is still humming pretty good, and boy, we've got a lot of stuff to sell, and we need people to sell it. The Bathrooms Are Coming, I found out eventually, It's actually a play, I believe, on The British Are Coming. It does not show up on the record album, but apparently in the live stage show, which I've seen pictures of, there was at least one or two numbers in which the cast was wearing Revolutionary War costumes, and there was even a cannon on stage at one point. So, yeah, the Las Vegas show was quite elaborate. So the premise of the show is that there's a couple of women who are very frustrated by their cramped, outmoded, inconvenient bathrooms, and they just feel trapped, and they wish something could be better, but they don't know what to do. And then they're at a museum, and there's a hall of statues, and there's a statue of a Greek goddess named Femma, who is the leader of all women's revolutions or something. And they jokingly say, "Oh, Femma, why don't you come to life and help us? We need you to lead a bathroom revolution. Oh, wouldn't that be funny?" And then the statue comes to life, and Femma is there to help the modern American women achieve their dream of an ultra stylish, super convenient, high-tech bathroom. And American Standard is going to be the way to do it, with all these new products that are rolled out, and the women are amazed by the new luxury tubs with the water jets, and the wonderful new sinks with the no-touch motion-activated faucets, and blah, blah, blah. And it's all a revolution, as my friend Jello Biafra, the punk rocker, says. It's the 60s, so there's a song about revolution, but it's all that energy is diverted into a revolution in bathrooms and giving women more consumer good luxury. So not exactly the zeitgeist that was really boiling in 1969, but they took what they could and retrofitted it into their own corporate goals. And you see this all the time with what's hot right now. Oh, the Beatles are hot right now. So in the mid 60s, you see songs that are sort of trying to reference a little bit of the yeah, 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 or the, right, the zingy guitars that they think the young people like, and just, oh yeah, we're hip now. B.F. Goodrich is hip and on the ball because we like rock and roll too. And then all the way down later, it's the disco sales meeting, like I was saying. So companies have this interesting tracking a little bit behind what's actually going on in the culture, and this sort of blurry, fuzzy Xerox of what's going on in the culture comes through their own weird filters a couple of years later. Very entertaining. I do believe that academics are going to be looking at this more over time, because there's so much to, as they say, unpack in this stuff.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I kept thinking about, you know, the woman, and you like play the whole song, because you have the film of it in the movie, or almost the whole song, where the woman is standing in the bathroom singing, "I'm free, you know, now at last I can really be me," in her bathroom. And it's like, talk about a bird in a golden cage. She's got to be like 5 minutes away from reading The Feminine Mystique by Betty Friedan.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've had a lot of interesting reactions from people who've seen the movie and seen that scene with this woman doing a duet with herself in her bathroom mirror, and talking about how now at last she can really be free in her private place, and it's a special place where she can be alone and be free. I've had interpretations about women saying, yeah, I remember my mother, when she was having a bad day, she would just go to lock herself in the bathroom for a while. Or I've even had people say, I think there's a subtext here about domestic violence and where women would escape to and lock the door to try to get away from trouble. And I thought, wow, I had not thought about that. I think this is all supposed to be luxury consumer goods, but who knows what weird themes could be legitimately teased out of this.
My favorite song among all of these, and I've listened to all three volumes, the 50s, 60s, and 70s, multiple times, is a song from a musical called Diesel Dazzle, about the diesel industry. And the song is called We Were There. And I'm going to play a minute or two of this song. And I was wondering if you could talk about your sense of kind of like the meaning of this song.
There was a desert that never saw a tree. Now it's an orchard green as far as you can see.
We were there. We were there. There was a marshland, nothing but mud and foam. Now it's a city where a million people call it home. We were there. Began to throb. We were there on the dunes and the river bank with the diesel to do the job. There was an SOS, survivors afloat. Then to the rescue came a simple fishing boat. We were there. We were there. We held the river back. We were there when Niagara roared. We were there when the oil well blew its stack. We were there when the well was bored. We were there when the trucker got the power boost, and the boost that he needed was large. We were there when the Boeing jet came to roost. You can bet that we gave him a charge. When Telstar went up in the sky to stay, we were there with electrical aid. We were there where the snow was being plowed away. We were there where the snow was made. We were there in the transcontinental bus. We were there in the old sawmill. We've been there every time they needed us. You can bet that we always will.
So Hank Beebe, who wrote the music for that 53 years ago, I've had hours and hours of conversations with this man. He's really quite a dear friend and a mentor and even a collaborator now. But he told me that during their intake with Detroit Diesel, one thing that came up is that the men out in the field running these franchise operations in different parts of the country, they felt not particularly connected to anything larger. Like, yes, this is the business, and oh, okay, so this engine has to go out and this one's got to be rebuilt, but why should we care, really? And people want to care and want to believe in the work that they're doing, and this comes up again and again. And so Hank and Bill wrote this song about, you know what, diesel engines are crucial to so many things going on every day, and when you're working on a diesel engine, you're helping putting a satellite into space, you're helping rescue people at sea, you're helping agriculture, you're helping transportation and construction. You are enabling the work of civilization. And it goes back again to why people loved these shows when they were done right. Just, yes, yes, I'm part of something bigger than myself. I'm part of something I can believe in. People up in the executive suite, they get it. They understand why we should all get up on Monday morning and keep doing this. So quite a catalog of the uses of diesel engines. But the bigger purpose was to remind people that this is a noble enterprise.
Well, it's so interesting to me because, yes, I mean, and when you're listening to it, you go, yep, every single one of those things is true and legitimate and... at, you know, and you get sort of get this like sense that diesel is the symbol of the strong, silent type of men who are omnipresent, and you know, they make modern life possible and feeding and, as you say, keeping them safe and creating new technologies. But what's so interesting to me is that the seeds of destruction are right there, like terrible agricultural practices, like watering a desert and turning it into an orchard. Just not a good idea.
Yes. Draining the wetlands.
Yeah, destruction of the wetlands, you know, nothing but mud and foam. It's like a history of industrialism encapsulated, and now here we are kind of sliding down the other side of that optimistic mythology.
Right. There's a very long history of progress symbolized by certain things. And for this show, it was, we're going to drain the swamps. We're going to pave this. We're going to impose vast swaths of monoculture on some unfriendly environment. That was the best understanding that they had at the time. I love old advertising of various sorts. In the early 20th century, there was no more powerful image of a company's success than a magazine advertisement that showed a factory belching enormous clouds of black smoke. This is the engine of American might. Look at all that smoke. We must be doing something right. So that was all they could understand then. And of course, now, decades later, we painfully come to understanding of, well, it's not that simple. You know, if you drain this and pave that, you're going to have trouble that's going to be very hard to unwind. And so we haltingly come to these new understandings, but we should look at these artifacts from 50 years ago with the understanding that they did not know what we now know. So that, again, is a case for the cultural historian to take the perspective on.
Well, exactly. And you know, here you are, you've basically, like an archaeologist, as you said in the film, unearthed a whole new field. And it's a practically countless number of these musicals. There's no record, as you say, there's no association. Even the companies themselves are largely unaware that these things were written. They don't seem to have archives. Now that the book and movie are out, I mean, do you see historians and academics taking an interest in this? And will there be ways for them to access all this material and for us?
Yeah, I've gotten inquiries from a few people now who are very excited about the implications and cultural and economic threads that you can pull out of this and tie together in new ways. And I don't think I'm the right person to write a very academic paper, but I'd be very happy to help people who do want to do that. I've got a lot of material and it's growing all the time. And of course, there are reams and reams of material still at Hank Beebe's house and Michael Brown's house and Sid Siegel's. And so at least now we know that these families are aware that this has larger, broader meaning. And a lot of stuff has been lost over the years, of course, but I think a lot of what remains will be protected. And you're right, by the way, that to a shocking degree, these corporations did not save this kind of material. It had such a limited shelf life, and sometimes companies are bought and sold and merged and things get thrown away anyway. But time after time, Deva would talk to a company about, do you know anything about these shows? Do you have any? Because we have one or two bits. And they're, what? A whole musical about selling cars? We did that? We had no idea. So we're also returning companies' histories to them as well as to the individual creators and performers. So that's kind of fun.
Well, kudos to Deva Wissanant, who is the filmmaker. It's just a beautifully crafted film, and it's now streaming on Netflix, so anybody can watch it. I was curious whether this whole part of your life has awakened an interest in you in regular Broadway musicals.
Yes, to a degree. As I mentioned in the movie, I grew up knowing basically zero about Broadway musicals. It wasn't something that my family ever listened to or attended. I grew up in semi-rural Massachusetts. I don't think I saw a musical until I was an adult out of college. So I knew that they existed, and I kind of looked with a sort of side-eye suspicion at the whole genre. Like, wait a minute, people start singing and dancing in the middle of a story? That seems kind of corny. So I had to be introduced to it by this sort of weird backdoor upside-down version where people are singing really catchy songs about photocopiers and how to sell the new line of dishwashers or whatever. So I came to understand, boy, these songs can be very catchy. And some of these shows, many of them, in fact, did have full plots and characters. It was a full book show. And so you'd kind of get a feeling for the bones of these things. Now, I would say there are some regular musicals that I do like very much. Of course, the Book of Mormon is fantastic. Hamilton is great. Some of the older ones like Kiss Me, Kate and Anything Goes. Very, very fun and funny and great songs. Some musicals I go, like about three of the songs and the rest of it I could get rid of. But so still somewhat cranky and cynical about that, but more of a fan than I used to be.
Well, Steve Young, I want to thank you so much for spending all this time with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. I love to talk about this. And I could not be more amazed and pleased by what Deva has done with this movie. It is deeply hilarious, but then it is so much more than that. People again and again tell us, well, we thought it would be funny. We didn't think we would be crying. We knew it would be good. We didn't know how great it could be. It's just so much more than people are expecting. And I could not be more delighted with the storytelling and wit and craft that she brought to it.
PDM can do what you want it to. PDM can show what you need to know. Through your distribution system, our sensors can be giving information automatically.
Can you tell me kilowatt hour consumption and demand?
Can do, can do.
Can you look and tell me where the voltage level stands?
Can do, can do.
We can tell you the position of a breaker or a switch. What can't we do?
Sing on pitch.
Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the LANL Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.